Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome to the 6th Annual Political Summit here in Annapolis, the Annapolis Political Summit, brought to you by Public Radio WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. We'll also be broadcasting on Delmarva Public Radio this week for this broadcast, our sister station in Salisbury, Maryland. My name is Mark Steiner. We're broadcasting today from Phillips Seafood Restaurant. We want to thank for their generous support in offering their facility to us this year again. And today begins the 426th legislative session of the General Assembly here, the State of Maryland. And as always, we are grateful to have as our first guest Senate President Mike Miller and Speaker of the House Michael Bush. Welcome, gentlemen. Good to have you both with us.
Good to be here, Mark.
And we want to thank our sponsors, the Maryland State Teachers Association. Their generous sponsorship allowed us to do this today. And our partnering organizations, WEAA 89.FM, the Maryland ACLU, and Maryland Healthcare for All Coalition. We're here to let you ask all questions you'd like to ask of our elected officials. And there's a microphone over here to my right, and we would like you all to line up and ask any question you'd like. And I would suggest if you really have a question, once we begin, to get up to the mic because it'll fill up fast, and we have an hour to do this in our first segment this morning with Speaker of the House, Mike Bush, President of the Senate, Mike Miller. Gentlemen, let the games begin. Let me ask you both this. Let's start this way. I found it really interesting that in the Baltimore Sun interviews with both of you over the weekend about this coming legislative session where we face this huge deficit in the state of Maryland, and many people have a lot of trepidation about what's going to happen with the state, that when asked what you thought the mood of the legislature would be coming into this session, Mike Miller, you were quoted saying we are carefully optimistic. And Mike Bush said, I think there's going to be a lot of anxiety coming into the session. So let's talk about those two perceptions of what we're about to face. I'm going to start with Senate President Miller.
Well, you know, today is a very significant day in the history of Annapolis and the state of Maryland. 225 years ago today, the Treaty of Paris was signed in the State House, ending the Revolutionary War. We formed a new government. They didn't have the money to pay for an army, didn't have money to pay for a navy, didn't have any government organized in terms of the states and how the states would vote in terms of a national government. In fact, half the population continued to support Great Britain. In fact, you look at these beautiful homes in Annapolis, they were seized from the Tories that continued to support Great Britain during the war. Those were very difficult times. And that's one of only really dozens and dozens of dozens of difficult, more difficult times than we have right now that the citizens of Annapolis and the people of Maryland have faced. And they've overcome. You know, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the happy warrior, he said, you know, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. You know, we're going to persevere and we're going to revive. And basically that's what Americans have done time after time when we're faced with crises. This is a recession. It's a deep recession, the longest recession and deepest we've had since World War II. Is it easy? No, it's not going to be easy. But with hard work and perseverance, we're going to prevail. And we're going to continue to recognize those issues and those groups and those interests which we as Americans feel important. I know one of your sponsoring groups is the Maryland State Teachers Association. The governor indicated in his talks yesterday that probably the only segment of the budget that's going to see an increase is the education group. And we're going to make certain that that's prioritized. And healthcare, public safety, the environment, they're all going to be level funded, maybe not cut. They're not going to be cut, but they're going to be level funded, which is not an increase. But it's a reason to feel optimistic.
Mike Bush?
I guess you have to be careful what you say in the Sun paper, first of all. But apprehensive, the fact that we're in a national recession. We've heard a lot about a stimulus package coming out of Washington, D.C. For all the different states, because obviously every state is running a deficit at this stage. We put a lot of effort into prioritizing the issues, as Senator Miller said, of how we want to put the state of Maryland forward. We made a huge investment in K-12 education of a general fund budget that's a little under $14 billion. $5.3 billion goes directly to county governments for K-12 education. We were ordered for that investment by being ranked the number one school system mm-hmm. in the United States of America, which I think is a great achievement. Having leveled funded tuition for the 3 years, we've made our university system some of the most affordable universities in the country. And I think that is the leading indicator to the business community why they'd want to settle and work and live in the state of Maryland. And I think that's one of the reasons that our unemployment rate is below the national average. But the fact that we're apprehensive is we have a $1.9 billion deficit. And the fact of the matter is that we will prevail, obviously. At the end of the day, we have to have a balanced budget. That's a constitutional mandate. The question is, how do we get there? Obviously, Governor O'Malley will bring the budget in a week from now. We will have to take a look at some of the programs that we invest in a few years ago and determine whether we are going to cut or level fund those institutions and those programs. I mean, we've already asked the state employees to take a furlough, 5 days. It's $34 million saved. We're looking to work collaboratively with our congressional delegation and our county governments to make sure that we continue to provide the essential services as effectively and efficiently as we possibly can. But that takes a lot of work. And obviously, I think with the leadership that Senator Miller and Governor O'Malley can bring to the table, we'll be successful come April 12th.
But I wonder, I mean, given the recession we are facing, and all the indicators are it could be very deep for the next 2 years in this country, and that unemployment, as of the other day nationally, was up to 7.2% and climbing. And so the question, where does government tighten its belt? I mean, people keep talking about cutting fat from the budget, and I'm not sure how much fat there really is to cut before you get down to bone and sinew. So I wonder, let's talk about some of the things that may have to go. I mean, there's been a battle for years over no tuition increases at our universities. And increasingly, more and more middle-class families and poor families are, their children are opting to go to state universities because they're affordable. Right. And more and more people are going back to colleges to retrain for jobs because they've lost their old jobs. So, and that's one of the easiest areas to where you can get revenue is from tuition. So what happens with, what do you think is going to happen, honestly, when it comes to tuitions at our universities in this next session and over these next couple of years? They're going to raise? Are they going to have to raise them?
Well, they should. This is the call of the governor. He really would like to go 4 years in a row without raising tuitions at the universities. We've taken our universities from the sixth most expensive in the United States to now the 16th. I was very proud to see in the Kiplinger report of the 100 best bargains in America, four of those are Maryland colleges, including University of Maryland College Park, which is the ninth best, most affordable college in the United States. But by the same token, the cost of living has risen. The cost of these universities is going up. The teachers' salaries are going up. Professors' salaries are going up. And they need to continue to recruit the very best and brightest if we're going to have these wonderful universities. Under the previous administration, tuition went up 44% during 4 years. 44% during 4 years. It was a tax on our citizens, a hidden tax. You know, Governor O'Malley has stated that he wanted to avoid that under all circumstances. I just don't think that this economy is going to allow him the luxury of continuing for the fourth year in a row of no tuition increase.
You agree with that, Mike Bush?
Let me just go back to the original question. First of all, I think you have to frame it in what's taking place on the national perspective. You know, President Bush and the Congress of the United States gave $700 billion to the banking industry, $700 billion. We don't exactly know where all that money is going. It's taxpayers' dollars. Theoretically, it cost every man, woman, and child close to $4,000 for that increase, with no limitations on bonuses and salaries for those in the financial business. It would be unfathomable for me to think that the Congress of the United States and President Obama, when he comes in, is not going to reach out and try to help those working men and women, those middle-class citizens that have done everything right, worked one and two jobs, pay their mortgage on time, pay their car payment, trying to get their kids through college. So I think it's imperative that the federal government step up and do the same thing for the states and the local governments that they've done for the financial industry to start with. And I think once they do that and we see what comes from the federal government, we'll be better able to assess what we can do for the citizens of the state of Maryland as well as the citizens in every state as their legislator comes in. But I think it's important for us to try to keep tuition at an affordable rate for families, many times both parents working, so they can go to the community colleges, so they can go to the four-year universities. But I do agree with Senator Miller in the bottom line that ultimately there has to be an incremental increase that keeps up with inflation. But for this year, when we're asking public employees to take furloughs and we're laying people off and they're being laid off in the private sector, you know, I think it's, you know, the federal government has to step up to the plate and do the same thing for the states as he did for the financial industry.
Well, I think it begs the question, then, what can a state do? What do individual states do to address the foreclosures, to address the unemployment rise, or just what you're talking about? Because people, let's say we raise tuition rates at our colleges, as one example we're talking about. I mean, that's going to be a tough burden on people in this state who are already stretching their dollars. I mean, if you have a household income, let's say, of 50 grand or 60 grand a year, and the tuition, and you have to come up with $15,000 or more when it comes to room and board and everything else to put your child in a state college. That's a huge amount of money. We're going to raise it one more time. So what? How do you respond? Where do new revenues come from? Do we go back to talking about expanding sales taxes? Do you go back to talk about raising gasoline
Let me just jump in here a second. I think Maryland made every effort last year to fund our programs appropriately. I thought we came in a special session, which served a tremendous amount of courage from Governor O'Malley and the legislature. To not only balance the budget, which we were left in a deficit, but also to go forward with our priorities of funding K through 12 education, higher education, and health care. The recession we're in is not caused by any individual state. It's caused by a lack of oversight, regulatory oversight on the financial markets that were on Wall Street. And the fact of the matter is that if we can reach down and take $700 billion of America taxpayers' dollars to right the banking industry so they can buy other banks, so they can go unfettered with bonuses, that they should be able to provide some incentives for those families to be able to afford to go to four-year institutions. And I think we have to work hard to do that.
So, Mike Miller, how do we do that? I mean, do you agree with your counterpart?
I do, in the sense that we are very fortunate to have the support we have on Capitol Hill. Nancy Pelosi is a Marylander through and through. Steny Hoyer has got the most senior job any Marylander has ever had in the state's history. He's majority leader of the Congress of the United States. Honestly and truly, half this stimulus package has not been identified. Both President Bush and President-elect Obama are in agreement that the money needs to be released post-haste. Hopefully it will be done before we're out of session. Okay, 16 senators yesterday sent a letter to the governor indicating that they would hope that some of the stimulus package would be directed to higher education. We're also hoping that some of it can be done in terms of public school construction. This governor has funded more for public school construction, $430 million last year, more than any governor in the history of the state in any one-year period of time. The previous administration spent $600 million in public school construction over the previous 4 years. Governor O'Malley, in his first 2 years in office, put up $730 million for public school construction. So the federal government is important. We're going to look at that stimulus and maybe adjust what we have to do in terms of our budget, but we're looking for some help. We're not looking for a complete bailout. I mean, this money is going to have to be paid back by Americans, all of us. So the further they go in debt, it's going to have to be made up by each and every one of us. But there is going to be a stimulus package, and based upon the people that we have on Capitol Hill, I assure you that Maryland is going to benefit, and benefit hugely, and hopefully it'll be in a way that we can react to it come April, or before we adjourn in April.
So the question I have, then, and pushing a little further, I mean, you're going to wait for the governor to bring his budget to the General Assembly. But you both have been in politics for a long, long time.
Right.
And you're not novices at this. So what do you think gets cut? Where does the paring begin? Well, what agencies start getting hit, and how does that happen? I mean, let's talk about the pain that people are going to have to feel in the reality of what we're facing right now.
Well, let me just suggest this and go to the budget for a second. You know, we are still in the 09 budget until July. The governor and the Board of Public Works have had to come back numerous times to pare that budget down. As
right.
I said,
right.
we've asked state employees to take 5-day furloughs as the year goes by. Many counties have done the same thing. We are going to have to go back to the Board of Public Works or in this year's budget and cut $400 million more just to balance the budget for 09. States have to balance the budget. The governor will bring in a budget with the lowest spending affordability limit this century, in the previous century as well, excuse me, as we move to 2009. But, you know, his unenviable task will be level funding most of the agencies. The legislature can only cut from that budget. So it's going to give us limited opportunities of where we're going to cut money. 67% of our budget is mandated, most of it in Medicaid and public education. Mm-hmm. The areas that we have flexibility is in higher education. So will tuition increases be one of the things that will be deliberated? Absolutely. Will some of the other non-mandated issues like the geographic index cost for education, will that be debated? Yes, it will. There are the areas where the state can go. Can we take a look at some of the special funds like open space and others? We could possibly bond that in the capital budget and look to use some of that cash. Can we use some of the rainy day fund? Yes, we might. Jim Smith, as the president of MACO, identified close to $360 million in reserves within the comptroller's office that we might be able to use on a one-time basis if we come up with a mechanism to pay it back. So there's numerous opportunities that we can take a look at, but I think the first thing we have to see is there going to be a stimulus package? Much has been talked about, an increased match in Medicaid, which means the federal government would put up more money, which would free up money in our general fund to pay for the issues like education and limiting increases in higher education tuition. It's a complex answer. That's why we go through the budget every year with a fine-tooth comb.
So one of the things that Mike was just mentioned, Mike Miller, was that these two areas, one area that most people never heard of, which is the money in the comptroller's office, which is what, $300-400 million?
Right.
360.
360. Thank you, Mike.
No, it's okay.
and the rainy day fund, $700 million?
Just a little under $800 million.
Thank you, Mike. do we dip into those funds to try to shore up we have, or does that money stay there?
Well, first of all, we manage government like each and every one of these good people out here in the audience do. They're concerned about their jobs, they're concerned about their house, they're concerned about their IRA, their savings. You know, government has to manage well. And where we can cut, we cut. But where we have some savings that we can dip into without damaging our AAA bond rating, we can do that. We have a source of income that was quite controversial. It went on the ballot and carried by every single county in the state, voted overwhelmingly in favor of it. And that's these video lottery terminals. Not because people liked them or they're even a good idea, but in competition with our sister states, Delaware and Pennsylvania and West Virginia. They're going to come on board within 2 years, and what we need is a temporary fix for that 2-year period when we get that other infusion of cash, and that we can use these monies, these rainy day funds, to help us bridge the gap between that new funding source. Also, as you indicated, the $300 million in the comptroller's office that we can use. And
who controls that? The legislature and the government, or the comptroller?
We're going to have to pass a law. To be able to use that, and we're also going to have to provide to pay it back at some point. It's going to be a one-time infusion of funds, and we're going to have to find a way to pay it back. And we can. But this is not gimmickry. It's sound budget management, but it's an effort to make certain that our good people, as Speaker Bush has indicated, people have played by the rules, you know, and they work hard and they pay their taxes and they obey the laws, that they don't have to bear an inordinate amount of pain. We're going to work hard to make sure that doesn't happen.
We're talking here in the 6th Annual Annapolis Political Summit. We're at Phillips Seafood Restaurant, WEA 80.9 FM, our home station, sponsored by the Maryland State Teachers Association, today with our partners, the Maryland Healthcare for All Coalition and Maryland ACLU, in front of a live audience. And we have a mic here to our right for people to ask questions, if you like, of our elected officials. Going back to where we are with our Senate President and Speaker of the House, Mike Bush, Senate President Mike Miller. So many people are arguing that the battlegrounds we're going to face in this coming session will be around social issues, since we can't argue much about fiscal policy in the sense that we're just going to have to bite the bullet and see what will happen, and we'll come back to some of those issues in a minute. But issues like the death penalty, let's just talk about the death penalty for a minute. That'll be one of the issues that will be coming up in this session very clearly. The latest poll by the Gonzales polling said that while 65%, I think I have this right, of Marylanders support the death penalty, that changes when you ask the question. If to 53% said that we could do without a death penalty if we had life without parole, guaranteed that the most vicious among us don't see the light of day. So, and there's always a very tight vote in those committees, especially in your house, Mike Miller, in the Senate. So let's talk about that. Where does this debate on death penalty go this year?
Well, what they don't understand, what they're not told, is I sponsored life without parole, and that's the law in the state right now. So when it goes to a jury, you know, a jury has the option of life, which is subject to parole, life without parole, or the death penalty. And they got 12 people have to be unanimous, you see, and subject to all types of reviews and appeals. Life without parole is the law right now. We have that. And so when people are informed that we have that and that's an option right now, 65% of the people think that should be an option. I understand the opposition, and it's very, very well-meaning. But I think that the majority of Marylanders are on the side of favoring it. For example, the hijackers, the people that crashed the plane into the CIA building, or people that crashed that organized the plane that crashed into Pennsylvania, you know, or the towers in New York. Or it's like I indicated in the paper, I have 12 small grandchildren. I buried 12 small grandchildren. If something happened to one of my grandchildren, like happened to the Lindbergh family, you know, several decades ago, where they kidnap a child, sexually abuse a child, and the child meets in death, I don't want the state sustaining that person. It's my personal feelings. I don't lobby anybody on the issue, just my feelings. And that's they've come from a long, long way back of thinking. Every senator and every member of the House of Delegates has their own views on this subject. It's not going to be changed by lobbying. The governor set up a commission. I could have told you what the vote on the commission would be the day he announced the appointments. When he announced the appointments, I could tell you what the exact vote would be following a year of discussion and debate and writing the report. It was 13-9, you know. And that's kind of the way it'll be in the Senate. That's the way it'll be in the House. It'll be a very close vote. The governor is going to push hard on it. He pushed hard last year. He's going to push hard again. He and I are going to meet this year. He's going to try to find some ways to move the bill forward. The committee it goes to is made up of seven Democrats and four Republicans. The chairman is a fairly liberal Democrat from Montgomery County, Brian Frosch. He's a great, great lawyer, great legislator. And they have these debates, they have the hearings, and after the debates and the hearings, the votes usually fall down to six in favor of retention and five for abolition. It's four Republicans are in favor of keeping it, as well as two Democrats. And it's a fairly close vote, But you don't change the committee members just to accommodate one idea, one bill. Maybe we will after the next election. But for the next 2 years, that's going to be the makeup of the Judicial Proceedings Committee.
Mike Bush?
Yeah, let me agree with Senator Miller on the fact that, you know, I was here and came in 1987 when the death penalty was a standard for the ultimate penalty under law. I think it was in the early 90s that we passed life without parole, which came up with really two ultimate penalties and gave options. And really, the death penalty, while I'm not a lawyer, it really is asked for by the state's attorneys of different counties. So you have 24 different state's attorneys out there determining whether they're going to ask for the death penalty or not. I would wager to say that in Baltimore City, Prince George's County, Montgomery County, over the last few years, under any circumstances, the death penalty has not been asked for, but rather life without parole. The question is, now that you have life without parole, and I think that was brought out into the polls, do you need the death penalty also as the ultimate penalty? And does the fact that there's been numerous people incarcerated and put on death row that were ultimately found innocent by DNA and in other evidence, not only in the state of Maryland but throughout the country, should we use the penalty of life without parole with the idea that down the line there could be some of these people found innocent? I mean, we find prosecutors all over the country that are trying to solve cases because they run for elected office as well. I think the Duke case in North Carolina was one of those cases that proved that. There was a recent case in Kentucky where a zealous prosecutor had put like 23 innocent people in jail, five or six on death row. So I think there's a serious debate that will come after the commission. And I think it'll be very close in both houses. But I do believe that we will see after the commission report whether it changes anyone's vote. We do not lobby on the death penalty. That is something that...
So you do not lobby on the death
penalty? No, we do not lobby on the death penalty. We've never lobbied on it since I've been in the legislature. That was one of two things that no one was ever lobbied on.
What was the other?
Abortion.
Abortion?
Abortion.
Abortion. I knew it. I knew
you'd get that.
We're sitting here in Phillips Seafood Restaurant with the Speaker of the House of Delegates, Mike Bush, and President of the Maryland State Senate, Mike Miller. We're sponsored by the Maryland State Teachers Association, who allowed us to make this happen this year. We're broadcasting from Phillips here on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. You'll also be hearing this on WSDL on the Eastern Shore and our sister station there on the Eastern Shore. And we're going to take a very, very short break and come back. When we do come back, we're going to be raising all kinds of issues from energy re-regulation or continued deregulation, what happens to BG&E, the question of alcohol and gas taxes, issues around moratoriums on foreclosures in the state of Maryland, what is the result of the ACLU case that was brought about, state police spying, will that legislation pass or not pass in this legislative session, and much more. And we encourage all of our guests here in our live audience here at Phillips Restaurant to stand up to the mic. This is your turn now to come up here and ask two of our leading officials in the state of Maryland any question you like. So do not go away. We will be right back. Hello and welcome back to the 6th Annual Annapolis Political Summit, brought to you by Public Radio WEAA 88.9 FM at Morgan State University, the voice of the community. We'll also be broadcasting this week on WSDL. We'll be picking it up on the Eastern Shore, Radio Delmarva. My name is Mark Steiner. We're broadcasting today from Phillips Seafood Restaurant, which generously gave us a facility to use for this 6th Annual Annapolis Political Summit. We're talking today as our General Assembly opens, our guests in the studio, so to speak, here at Phillips, our Senate President Mike Miller and Speaker of the House of Delegates Michael Bush, and our lead sponsor, the Maryland State Teachers Association, that made all this possible. And our other two partners here today who brought many people down to Annapolis, Healthcare for All is with us, and the Americans of Liberty Union, Maryland, our other two sponsors here this morning who helped us get this off the ground. And I just want to welcome a few people here. We have students here today from Morgan State University and St. John's College right here in Annapolis, and it's great to have them in our audience, along with the Baltimore Freedom Academy, one of the great charter schools in Baltimore, brought down lots of students and teachers here to join us today. Baltimore Urban Leadership is here as well, and it's always great to have young people in the audience, students and teachers who make up our future, and I'm glad to have so many of them in the audience with us here today. And this is probably the largest audience and the most diverse audience we have ever had here for the 6th Annual Political Summit, as it should be, reflecting all of us. So it's great to have all of you here. So let's wade into this. Now, I said we're going to get to the microphones, which are to my right. So folks, if you have questions, that's why you're here, please line up to ask them. And our first question, please identify yourself and ask your question.
Thank you, Mark. I'm Vinny DeMarco. I'm president of the Maryland Citizens Health Initiative. And I thank you and WEAA for doing this and allowing us to be a part of it. It's a great event. And I want to first congratulate Speaker Bush and President Miller for the Governor's Working Families and Small Business Healthcare Coverage Act of 2007, which brought Maryland from 44th in the country to 21st in healthcare coverage for adults. And since it took effect, 25,000 people have gotten health care who didn't have it before, and that's really wonderful, and it helps all of us by reducing uncompensated hospital care. My question is, are you committed to keeping that program and making sure it takes full effect? And it took effect partly for parents and for non-parents, takes effect July 1, 2009, and we hope that you're committed to making sure that all 100,000 people who are now going to be eligible for that program can enroll in it.
Speaker Bush, you
quite candidly,
first?
I believe that we are committed to the 100,000 people that are enrolled in it. We did that through a federal match and the use of funds that came from the trade-off with the medical malpractice premiums when they paid that back, and from MHIP money. But I do think we have to note that Chairman Pete Hammond and Chairman Mac Middleton did a wonderful job of collaborating on that with the governor, and it's a classic example where people goodwill came together to enhance Medicaid eligibility, where you now insure people under 150% of poverty. And as we heard from Steny Hoyer yesterday, that the federal government is considering passing legislation this week that will ensure every child, the enhancement of the Children's Health Insurance Program, will get health insurance. I think one of the things that we look forward to in the area of health care in particular is the new Obama administration and the Democratic Congress, both in the House and the Senate, looking for new ways to expand health care coverage. For the last 8 years, most of the states have been out there on their own initiatives trying to take this on. You cannot do this without a partnership from the federal government. Our budget in Medicaid is growing faster than any budget that we have, and we really need some direction and coordination from the federal government. But hopefully, before the end of this 4 years, that we will ensure more Marylanders, to give them access to the great hospital system and doctors that we have here.
Mike Miller.
Tom Daschle is a personal friend of mine. He, when I was head of the, what they call the Democratic Legislative Campaign Committee, he was majority leader of the United States Senate. He's a very decent, caring, honest person, person who brings people together. He's going to be in charge of trying to bring universal health coverage to the United States of America. I'm confident that, unlike past attempts by people like Harry Truman and Richard Nixon and Bill Clinton, that he's going to be able to accomplish his goal. But in the meanwhile, you know, the state of Maryland is not in the business, going to be in the business of knocking people off the health care rolls. I mean, once you have somebody, you give them a benefit, you don't take it away. You move on, you adjust, but you find a way to make ends meet to keep your commitments.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, a quick follow-up to that. I'm curious about the funding. How does it get paid for, given what we're facing?
Last year was an enhancement that was put forth by both Health Committee in the House and the Senate, whereas we took the surplus funding from the Maryland Health Insurance Program, which was a safety net. They had a surplus, which was one-time money, and the settlement from the medical malpractice premiums that were paid back to the state to be able to match federal funds, and we can match federal funds with that money, to enhance the eligibility for Medicaid and put adults with children onto the rolls, and then have a program to put childless adults onto those rolls. So we hope that through the funding source there that we can continue to do that. Chairman Hammond is looking at ways to deal with the development of disabled and using money to be able to match some of that as well. Much is innovation and effective ways to try to match federal funds to be able to create this eligibility. So we're in the works of trying to do that. We were very successful last year. As Vinny has said, we had 100,000 people sign up that are now enrolled. I believe the more people that are enrolled in health care, it actually saves money. It's estimated that every family that has health insurance to cover the 700,000 people that don't have it, that go ultimately to the emergency room, cost you an extra $1,000 to $1,500 a year on your health insurance premiums to offset the uncompensated care that's paid for, because it's got to be paid for somewhere, because our hospitals are under the all-payer system and our physician groups are getting paid.
Thank you so much, Vinny. Any other questions coming to the mic now? We'll take a question or I'll go right ahead.
Yeah, Don Rush from Public Radio Delmarva, and I just want to say it's a pleasure, Mark, to air your program on the Eastern Shore. First time, I think.
It is. Good to have you partners with you all. It's good to have you.
My question concerns the Chesapeake Bay. We're talking about not meeting the 2010 deadlines now for cleaning up the bay. Given the kind of new restrictions that we have, new regulations in the poultry industry, which many in the poultry industry feel created very major burden for them, and also the new restrictions on crabbing and many of the watermen who also have seen this dramatic effect on their industry. How do you, on the one hand, move ahead with trying to clean up the bay, and on the other hand, try to ease at least some of the burden of these restrictions, certainly financially, and how do you do that in a very economic tight time?
What we're also looking at doing is curbing urban sprawl. The governor's got a commission. It's given a report this week, and you know the counties are not happy with it, but because it gets the state involved in the zoning mechanism to steer development where development is taking place at the present time. So we're going to be looking at that, and it's going to be quite contentious. I mean, extremely contentious, because the environmentalists feel that the commission did not go far enough. The counties feel that they went too far in intruding upon their space. But we're going to move forward on that, and it's going to be quite debated. But we're going to pass some meaningful legislation. The other area is we're going to be looking at the septic tanks and phosphorus. Anne Arundel County just defeated a bill which would require people to have septic tanks that address the phosphorus and nitrogen. And we're going to be looking at that in terms of a statewide bill, at least homes in proximity to the bay and to the tributaries. We're also going to be looking at educating the homeowners in terms of what their runoff from their lawns, from the fertilizers, do with regard to the bay. It's going to be attacked in a dozens of different ways, including increased forestation on the bay, addressing the wetlands. We don't have the money we'd like to put into the bay, but we've thus far kept in place at least $25 million for the Chesapeake Bay Trust Fund, which was new money as of last year in terms of helping the farmers and the counties adapt and adjust to saving, preserving the Chesapeake Bay. One of the speaker's legacies of mine is education, education, education. I'm the oldest of 10 children, public school kids, went to land-grant colleges. Now I am, among others, going to focus on the Chesapeake Bay. We're number one in education. We're not going to go backwards, but we're going to focus on the Chesapeake Bay and find a way to preserve and protect the largest estuary in the United States and the jewel in the state of Maryland. And we're committed to do it. This governor's committed to do it. On the Board of Public Works, very soon, is going to have one of the largest land acquisitions in the history of the state of Maryland. It's going to be quite controversial. It's saying, how can you spend money to preserve open space? How can you buy this land in such tough times? This is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. This was land acquired by the Jesuits from the Indians. I mean, before the state was even a state, and they've held it. It's pristine. In fact, some of our early settlers are there, thousands of acres, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. I would equate it to Seward acquiring Alaska, Jefferson making the Louisiana Purchase. It's an opportunity that we cannot let pass by.
There's not a whole lot I can add to what Senator Miller said. He's absolutely correct. I think this year it'll be about land preservation. and the regulations dealing with smart growth that the commission the governor set up has come back. There are points that would be debated between the environmental community and the counties as far as development, but really the overdevelopment of the estuaries and the bay have had a lot to do with it. We do have a program to try, as the senator said, to preserve land. We're going to preserve 9,200 acres, 4,700 of those on the eastern shore. The others are in St. Mary's County, which belong to the Jesuits. You know, we worked a couple years ago with the environmentalists and the farmers to deal with runoff and nitrogen into the bay. We hope that that has had some effect. We also need help from our neighbors in Pennsylvania and Virginia. And I think that the fact that you have three Democratic governors in Kane, Rendell, and O'Malley that basically have the same goals, maybe we can accomplish some things there on the national level as well. So we're hopeful that we're going to continue to have a legacy of the Chesapeake Bay, which we can pass on to the next generation.
Just quickly, any expected help from Annapolis for the watermen and for the farmers in terms of implementing these kinds of regulations or being hit economically? Any plans at all?
Well, the farmers, you know, we had huge amounts like for cover crops and Marbidco. I mean, whereas the budget was growing by 3%, they had 7% increases in a lot of farm legislation. So I know this governor is aware of their problems. He attended the Farm Bureau convention in Ocean City last year. He's going to be speaking to the farming group in February at the agricultural dinner in Glen Burnie. So he's going to be working closely with both the farmers and the watermen.
Next question, and this, we have someone else at the mic.
Hi, I'm Jane Martin, an Annapolis businesswoman, and I want to thank you for taking questions from the audience. As this is directed to Speaker Bush. As an ACLU of Maryland member, I'm very concerned about the continuing revelations beyond what was disclosed in this DSACS report. Yet Maryland has no law protecting our First Amendment rights from spying and dossier compilation. Will you today pledge to work with the ACLU and your colleagues in the House of Delegates to enact legislation to prohibit law enforcement spying and dossier gathering on political groups in Maryland?
Look, I think that what took place by the state police was something that should not be tolerated in the state of Maryland or any other state in the country. We are working to try to correct that. That will be in front of the Judiciary Committee. We do not believe that people should be involved in spying that took place. So, yes, we will move forward with legislation that will correct that inequity.
Thank you.
Will it go through the Senate?
We're going to look at it. You know, the governor hasn't introduced his bill yet, or we haven't seen the workings of it. But we all agree that what took place was horribly, terribly wrong, and we're going to make sure it doesn't happen in the future. And the governor is, you know, is going to present this bill, and we want to see if it goes far enough to address your concerns. But I assure you that, given the opportunity, I will vote for the bill.
I'll wait for another question. There's someone else up there, and we'll. Yeah, there is. Good, sir. Go ahead.
Good morning. My name is Robert Strupp with the Community Law Center in Baltimore. My question at first is going to appear a little technical, but I assure you it's going to come out to be a question that will relate to both the budget and combating some of the predatory real estate practices that are part of the foreclosure crisis that we're facing. In special session, the legislature closed a loophole regarding limited liability companies in real estate valued at over $1 million, but it didn't deal with those transactions, the thousands of transactions that occur every year between $1 and $1 million. And there, if those were also required to pay the transfer and recordation taxes as well as record in land records, there would be additional revenue to Baltimore City and the counties. Moreover, it would also identify and provide some transparency with regards to these real estate transactions that in many cases are actually contributing to some of the fraud and deception that are going on throughout the state. So my question is, would you all support reducing the threshold from $1 million to a dollar. And also, another thing, Maryland, unlike many other states, when you apply for a charter for a limited liability company with the State Department of Assessments and Taxation, you don't have to disclose who the owners of the limited liability company are. You only disclose who's forming that entity and who the resident agent might be. Would you support legislation that would require the members of limited liability companies to be identified? These kind of transparency innovations would help cut back on some of the fraud and deception that's going on. Thank you.
I was unaware of the loophole, quite frankly. I, you know, when we passed the bill, we were trying to look at shopping centers. People would transfer the shopping center, one corporation to another, and they would want to keep retaining the stock, and therefore they wouldn't pay the transfer tax. So when you sell your home, somebody pays a transfer tax. Sometimes it's divided equally. Sometimes the seller pays. Sometimes the buyer pays. Everyone should pay the transfer tax. And like I say, I was unaware of the $1 million loophole. I will look at it and I'll see where we go from there.
Mike Bush?
Yeah, I think that obviously was a compromise as it went through the process. I wasn't aware of it myself. The bill was known as the controlling interest bill. And I was here along with Senator Miller when we expanded the limited liability companies, and actually the fiscal note on the original bill was zero, and then they found the loophole to use it to avoid the transfer tax, which every other Marylander pays. We will certainly take a look at the loophole between $1 and $1 million. Obviously, that's, you know, one of the things we come back every year for somebody to put in legislation, sponsor, to have the debate and listen to both sides. And the issue about the disclosure as far as the filing is something, and I would encourage you to find a sponsor in the appropriate committee to put it in so you can come to Annapolis, debate the issue, and see if we can go forward with it.
The question, to follow up on that, one of the things that he alluded to was the effect and cost this has on local jurisdictions, counties, and the city of Baltimore. One of the largest budget items we have in the state has to do with money that affects and goes back to local jurisdictions. That's where people keep saying the argument's going to take place in the state legislature, and where the deepest cuts may be going back to the to our local jurisdictions and what they lose. What do you gentlemen think is going to happen there?
Well, 40% of our budget goes to local jurisdictions.
Exactly.
So, you know, during the past 10 years, they've gotten double-digit increases. You know, this year, in many areas, they're going to be level funded. It's not going to be a decrease, just they're not going to be able to get the increase that they've been accustomed to in the past.
So you don't how deep do you think it'll be?
Well, it's going to be severe. I mean, if they're not getting increase, if they're not getting a 10% increase, you know, one of my counties, Calvert County, they've built up a very healthy rainy day fund, like almost $100 million in rainy day fund because of the money we've been sending back from the counties. The Calvert County pays their teachers at a better rate than even Montgomery County. It's a very, fairly wealthy county. And, you know, they're going to be very chagrined because that money's not going to be coming back in terms of health, in terms of libraries, in terms of public safety, you know, in terms of, you know, monies that we've just been very generous with before that we had the excess and send it back to do good. So, as the governor's going to indicate later on at 8:30, many of these departments are going to level fund. Community colleges, for example, level fund. We'd like to increase the money, but we're not going to be able to.
Let me just say this. First and foremost, the partners, you know, the county governments are partners with us in delivering services. We all represent the same people, ultimately. We have a good working relationship with MACO, Jim Smith, Wilson Perrin. We're going to work very closely with them to find out how we can most efficiently and effectively provide those services in tough economic times. Ultimately, come April 12th, we have to balance our budget by law. After that, the counties get their budget. They have to balance their budget. We're not like the federal government. This is going to be a tough session, but I think everyone has to address their priorities, make some concessions both on the local level and the state level to best do that. And the only way to do that is to have a collaborative relationship. As Senator Miller has said, 40% of our budget goes to local government. We're the only state in the union that gives police aid. $5.3 billion, better than a third of our budget, goes back in K-12 education. We invest heavily in the community colleges. At least 25 to 30% of the cost comes from the state for our community colleges. So those areas are areas that, you know, no one wants to cut, but we're going to have to take a look at. in order to balance the budget. We're one of 17 states, of only 17 states, that actually contributes to school construction. And as President Miller said, this year Governor O'Malley will meet his commitment for $1 billion, which he committed to for a four-year period of time and a three-year period of time. That builds better schools in our communities. And we're the only state in the union that gives local county governments a taxing source that is a state taxing source, our number one taxing source, which is income tax. They get to have a piggyback tax. We're at 4.75. Most of the counties are 3.2. All that money comes directly back to every county. Many counties have passed tax, property tax cap and homestead tax caps, so they don't have to use the property tax, but they've utilized the state income tax. So we're very much in this together. We're very much going to work with the counties to make sure that our services are provided. But at the end of the day, both the counties and the state have to balance their budget.
So tighten your belts. Serious cuts are going to come to localities, what we're hearing. We have one last question for this hour, and please come to the mic.
Great. Thank you very much. And thank you, President Miller and Speaker Bush, for giving us your time. This is great. I'm Dr. Margaret Flowers. I'm a co-chair of the Maryland Chapter of Physicians for National Health Program, which is a 501c3. We educate about health policy. I also represent Healthcare Now of Maryland. And I just wanted to say that Maryland is a very wealthy state, but yet we rank 32nd in the nation for our health outcomes. And we also know that in terms of quality of care that Medicaid patients receive, we rank 46th. We know that we're probably going to get, with the economic recovery package, some state dollars for health care. And I'm wondering, are you going to use these state dollars to maintain the current fragmented, very inefficient, and unequal system of health care? Or are you willing to work with us to create a system that covers every resident of the state of Maryland with a single standard of care? We know that these systems are more cost effective, and they also improve quality of health care.
Well, first of all, this is a very complex area. Like I say, we're certainly willing to work with you in terms of trying to guarantee every citizen with adequate health care. But at the same time, we're getting pushed by the physicians in the state of Maryland who are concerned in terms of physician reimbursement, that they're not adequately being reimbursed for their services. Just this week, I met with the emergency room doctors throughout the state who are working longer and for less pay, and yet they're becoming the healthcare providers of first resort in the state. So we have a lot of areas that we need to be addressed, and one of the things that's going to be first and foremost on our mind is healthcare.
I believe that every year we come to Annapolis and have tried to expand the coverage for healthcare. I used to chair the healthcare committee before I became the speaker. I think Pete Hammond has been one of the most progressive healthcare chairman that we've ever had in Annapolis, along with Mac Middleton, and they work all the time to try to expand healthcare. We're the only state that has an all-payer system that you're aware of that makes sure that we compensate for all the hospital costs across the state. We have no public hospitals per se in the state of Maryland. There's no such thing as dumping patients in a public hospital. Every one of the community hospitals takes their share of uncompensated care. We also have the finest trauma system in the country, as far as I'm concerned. We do have challenges in the area of a lot of urban poor that don't have health care. Many times, even though we have programs for Medicaid and CHIPs, people don't actually sign up to it until they come to the hospital, and we have to enroll them in the hospitals just to get them in a program to be eligible for the programs that are available to them. I do believe that we need some help and direction from the federal government as we go forward. A few years ago, we were very successful in keeping Blue Cross Blue Shield here as a nonprofit when they wanted to convert for for-profit. I think that was key to people receiving coverage in the workplace that we have now. But we work every day in Annapolis. We have a committee dedicated just to trying to expand healthcare services. I think that that committee has done a great job, and we will continue to go in that direction, and we know we have a lot of challenges.
But are you willing to work with us to create a single system for the state of Maryland that covers everybody?
Let me suggest this to you. We've worked with every group that's come to Annapolis. You can ask Mr. DeMarco whether we've tried to work with him over the years, and every group that comes to Annapolis that testifies, and we try to work with every group to try to expand coverage to as many people as we possibly can. We were in the forefront of the CHIPS health program. We were one of the states that put in a program that was lauded by the federal government, where we actually got more money to expand for children. Last year, we expanded health care for 100,000 more individuals and increased our Medicaid rate from 72% of poverty to, I believe, 150% of poverty. So we are trying everything we can to work with not only the providers in the community, but also the citizens and the business community to make sure everyone has access to quality health care.
Thank you.
I think we are just about out of time for this segment. I want to encourage everyone to stay with us. We'll be back in just a few minutes. When we do come back, we'll be talking with Governor Martin O'Malley, who will be joining us here. I want to thank Speaker of the House of Delegates Michael Bush and Senate President Mike Miller for joining me here at Phillips Annapolis to discuss what the citizens of Maryland can expect from this session. Gentlemen, thank you both so much for being here. So again, don't go away. Martin O'Malley will be joining us in just a few minutes. He'll spend the next hour talking with us about his agenda for this legislative session. Folks, if you all could just stay here for just 1 minute. And we'd like to thank the Maryland State Teachers Association for their generous sponsorship for making this event possible, and our partners will be EAA, 88.9 FM, the Maryland ACLU, and the Maryland Healthcare for All Coalition. We'll be right back. Stay with us.